Hello, everyone, and welcome to At the Letters for February the 8th, 2024. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, alongside Arden Zwelling, and this show is produced this week by Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. So we will get to the Justin Turner news, the Vlad Guerrero Jr. news, and start casting ahead as well. But Arden, I don't know about you, I'm just at this point in the offseason, having kind of followed all of the ups and downs, I'm just ready for actual baseball.
Well, the good news for you is this is the last week without some sort of baseball activity for the next 8 months.
Yeah, I'm actually really relieved to hear that and to know that, because look, this offseason, it just wasn't a good offseason for the Blue Jays, really from start to finish. And I'm not saying it was disastrous. I'm not saying they still can't have a really good team in 2024. But if you're just looking at this offseason in isolation, there was a lot of disappointment. There were a lot of letdowns, even right down to the Vlad Guerrero Jr. arbitration hearing where they go to ARB with Vladdy. He ends up beating them in that case, which we'll get to. But it's not to say it's a disaster, but it wasn't a great offseason. And I think, you know, fans certainly frustrated, understandably so. I think at this point it is what it is, and I am looking forward to just actually looking at the games and looking at what this team will be once it takes the field.
Yeah, it's definitely not the outcome the Blue Jays are hoping for coming into this offseason, quite clearly. Obviously not the outcome any Blue Jays fan was hoping for. Like, I don't think you ever get your ideal 99th percentile offseason ever. I don't think you ever go into an, you know, come out of an offseason saying we did exactly what we wanted to do. Like, everything fell into place. Every free agent loved the opportunity that we had for them. Every dollar fit perfectly in our budget. Every trade negotiation just fell into our lap and the value was amazing. And we came out like so much better than we were last year. Like, I think you're always dealing with some level of compromise and you're always kind of dealing with, you know, an outcome that isn't your ideal favorite outcome, but is one that, you know, you can at least live with and be settled with. So, like, where do you think this was, like, on the percentile gauge, where do you think this falls for the Blue Jays in terms of this outcome for their offseason?
Yeah, once you started phrasing it that way, that's where my mind went. And without having given this too much thought, like, I don't know, I'm inclined to say like 30th. What do you think?
Yeah, I might go a little higher than that. It's I might go like 40th, 45th. I don't think it's above 50.
No.
Because I just think that, yeah, a lot of the avenues that the Blue Jays wanted to go down just led to dead ends, unfortunately for them and unfortunately for fans. That's the context of this offseason, right? Is that the Blue Jays came into it wanting to make like the splash of all splashes and pouring a ton of time and energy and resources into a recruitment of Shohei Ohtani, and he ends up choosing the Dodgers. And then they fly to California to meet with Yoshinobu Yamamoto. He ends up choosing the Dodgers. They talk to the Padres about Juan Soto, and the Yankees show up with an offer that I don't think the Blue Jays would and probably could not beat. So Soto goes to the Yankees. You could probably say something similar for Jorge Polanco, although, you know, I don't know how much interest the Blue Jays had there, but I don't think the Blue Jays would have beat the package the Mariners put together. And then they looked at what was already a very weak free agent class and saw two players in terms of position players and saw two players atop that market in Cody Bellinger and Matt Chapman, who have a ton of red flags and who have very high asking prices from an agent who is very difficult to deal with. And I think the Blue Jays said, we don't really feel like taking on that much risk and that much commitment for some players with a lot of red flags in their profiles, particularly when our competitive window might be closing in 2 years. So let's just do like the prudent, unsatisfying thing and spread around our money to a bunch of mid-tier free agents on short-term deals who plug some roster holes and see how things go over the first 100 games and try to get better at the trade deadline.
Yeah, just on Polanco real quick, because you mentioned him, I get the sense that the Mariners were by far the most motivated team there. And I think the questions around injuries and his defense, like, I don't think the Jays were a close second on that. I think the Mariners were by far the team that was most motivated there. You know, if we were to ask Ross Atkins and he was, you know, going to be super, super forthcoming with us, clearly, I think his answer would be a lot higher. He might say, I don't know, was this the 60th percentile outcome for them? I mean, we all know what the 99th was. We, you know, it wasn't that. The Jays internally, I think, believe in some of their own internal players, and that's going to be a bet that, you know, we'll see how that pays off. And in my opinion, I personally think, and I've said this, you know, over the course of the last few months, I thought Rhys Hoskins would have been a guy that they should have spent more money to get. I thought Willy Adames would have been a guy that they should have, you know, found a way to trade for. In theory, that still could happen, although I'm not holding my breath there. And maybe round that out with guys like IKF, or, you know, of course, we've talked about other names there that could be fits to round out a roster. But, you know, here we are. They've landed on Justin Turner as one of the key parts of this offseason. And it's going to be really interesting. I mean, there are a lot of ways we can take this with Justin Turner, but this is a guy who's historically been really, really good every single season since he broke out 10 or 11 years ago.
Just before we go there, like, am I missing another position player who got traded who is really impactful other than Polanco and Soto? That's it, really.
I mean, you could. I wouldn't say that Eugenio Suarez is like super impactful. Yeah. You know, now he actually,
even putting Polanco in that discussion is like even a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I think Polanco's like kind of comparable to Turner, probably like a two WAR player. I think Eugenio Suarez is, you know, more like a one WAR player. That being said, like if the Jays had Suarez, it would just deepen things a little bit. Like that's not a fit for this team. Obviously, he's in Arizona now, but. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a list in front of me, but off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of other big names who moved.
Yeah, so I just think that like the circumstances of this offseason were really unideal for the Blue Jays to address some of the things they needed to address. And that's not to excuse them. Like, look, their job as a front office is to make the team better and to get deals done and to know when you need to take on a bit more risk or push beyond your comfort zone in order to capitalize on, you know, a window that is rapidly closing with, you know, two very young, very good elite talents, you know, under your control for only two more years. But, you know, they went down the Shohei Ohtani route. He chose somewhere else. I mean, they just did not have the prospect capital to beat the Yankees in a trade for Juan Soto. I agree with you. I think Rhys Hoskins or JD Martinez would have been better fits for the spot that Justin Turner ended up filling. But beyond that, like, are people really ruining that the Blue Jays didn't add Mitch Garver or Teoscar Hernandez or Jock Peterson? Like, yeah, these guys would have helped. But in terms of, like, the big swing impact talent, the Blue Jays were, it seems, involved on all of those guys. The conditions just were not favorable for them to get something done.
Yeah, and as you said there, the job of a GM is to turn unfavorable conditions into favorable conditions, right? It's like you're going up against 29 other individuals who are actively working against you and competing for the same resources and players and talent. And so your job is to navigate that situation and make sure that your roster is elite regardless of the challenges that you face. And like I said, we'll see where this lands for the Blue Jays. They've, at this point, and this is why I'm kind of a little bit done with the offseason talk, is like we can debate it all day long, and we've debated it for months now, and like I'm just not sure there are a lot of new takes to be had. We all know this wasn't the plan A for the Blue Jays. We can all look at this roster and say there are real questions here. This is not a perfect team. This was not a perfect offseason, and if you're a fan listening to this and you're disappointed, like pretty understandable why. But at the same time, going over it for the 10th time, I'm just like, I don't know. Like, do we really? And this is why I'm just glad that spring is approaching because, yeah, like there's not a lot more nuanced arguments to be had. It wasn't a very good offseason.
Yeah, there's a real vacuum of like concrete, material, substantive things to talk about right now because no game that matters has been played yet. And by the way, no game that matters will be played for like two more months. So get ready for spring training, Ben, because I don't know that that's really going to change things in terms of the discourse and discussion about what the Blue Jays may or may not be. But yeah, it is like it's probably just even overcomplicating like what is going to lead to the success or failure of the Blue Jays to get really caught up in like the marginal differences in the projections between like a Turner and a Martinez or like the amount of risk that you would be taking on in a multi-year pact for a Soler versus a one-year deal for Turner Martinez, you know, worrying too much about like the handedness of the bench bats and, you know, The 40 or 50 plate appearances that Dalton Varsho might need to take against a lefty and not the most ideal circumstances. Like, really, the success or failure of the Blue Jays as a team, offensively, at least, this isn't to touch their pitching staff, but just offensively, how they're going to be better offensively in 24 than 23 is going to be Bo Bichette, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., George Springer. Like, those are the three players who are going to take the most plate appearances on this club if healthy. And those are three players who have been elite in their careers. And, you know, with Springer, he's a bit of a different conversation. But for Bichette and Guerrero, you're talking about two guys in their mid-20s who should be entering their primes and putting up, like, really, really high-impact offensive seasons.
Bo Bichette with a high fly ball to left. Ramirez back, turning and watching, and it is gone. Number 20 on the season for Bo Bichette, and it is now 8-5.
Boy, that was a no-doubter. A little bit of a smile from Bo Bichette. Milestone home run.
It really does, like, not to be too reductionist, but it really does come down to those three players playing to their potential, just considering the volume of plate appearances they're going to be taking, particularly in big spots for your club. If you get really good seasons from those three, I think the Blue Jays are going to have a good season offensively.
Right. And so this is where, you know, when I say, like, hey, they didn't have a very good offseason, well, look, they're making the case, they're making the bet that maybe they didn't have to have an amazing offseason. Maybe they just had to have a solid offseason, and they're going to be good enough regardless, because with a solid offseason, which, you know, again, we'll see if this turns out to be one or not in time, but with a solid offseason, maybe you get those internal improvements. Maybe it goes a step further and your Spencer Horowitzes and your Alan Rodens and maybe Aurelvis Martinez or Damiano Palmigiani, maybe some of these guys emerge as real players in the course of a season who are hitting, you know, doubles and home runs and singles in big spots for this team. And it turns out that you didn't actually have to go out and rely as heavily externally. But at this point in time, in February, as we're looking at this, that's a lot of uncertainty. We don't know if that's actually going to happen.
And it would be cool if you got those good stories over the 200, 250 plate appearances that you could see in, like, a really good case scenario from a Palmigiani or an Alan Rodin or a Martinez. But, like, the bulk of what's going to power this team is the 600-plus plate appearances from a Bichette, from a Guerrero, from a George Springer, who led the Blue Jays in plate appearances last season. You know, Dalton Varsho is likely to flirt with 600 plate appearances as well. Alejandro Kirk will be in, like, the 450 range. You hope Danny Jansen is also in the 450 range. Like, that's what's powering your club. Like, that is what is really going to do the majority of the heavy lifting when it comes to success or failure offensively. Sure, it'd be nice to have, like, a Robbie Grossman on your bench to match up against lefties late in games when Kiermaier Varsho is coming up, but we're talking about just a much smaller percentage proportionally. It's not that it's not important, but, like, it is sort of missing the forest for a trees a bit to, like, really focus in with a laser eye on some of these small marginal things on the edges and ignore, like, the core of this team, which is mostly still intact from last year and has to be better for the Blue Jays to have better outcomes offensively.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is where, from a narrative standpoint, from a fan enjoyment standpoint, you take last year's team. That just wasn't a fun team. I don't think anyone involved with that team would say it was a fun team. And then you sort of run it back. And it's like, okay, I guess we're just hoping it's going to be more fun next year. And, like, look, it actually could be, because every baseball season is its own season. And I've said this before, but, like, you know, when opening day comes around and the Blue Jays are playing the Rays at Tropicana Field, nobody is going to be thinking about anything that happened in 2023. It's a new year. And so that does bring with it new possibilities, both, you know, good and bad. And, you know, I think that at the center of that, you know, or somewhere in the middle of that will be Justin Turner. So when you saw that the Blue Jays had landed him on that 1-year, $13 million deal, what did you think?
I apologize for derailing us, and I thank you for putting us back on the tracks there. The Blue Jays, they made their, I guess, their marquee signing of the offseason in Justin Turner. It depends how you feel about Yariel Rodriguez, if and when that gets to the finish line. But yeah, what did I think? I thought, well, you know, what I've said on previous podcasts, that I preferred JD Martinez and I preferred Reese Hoskins in this market, but I think I like the Turner fit more than I liked the Peterson fit. I like the Turner fit on a short-term deal more than I liked Soler on a multi-year pact.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and I know you feel that way as you know, Jorge Soler hater number one in this market.
Gotta say, but I was a tiny bit relieved when they didn't sign Soler. Gotta admit that. I just I could have worn it. I was willing to wear it, but yeah, it was a little relief that set in.
No, but I think you were right in saying like he just never felt like a fit for the Blue Jays. Like, yeah. He just never felt like a target for them. And it just didn't really make sense for a number of reasons. But, you know, with Turner, like it just sort of, it depends on if he has like one more well above average season in him. Like he's already been bucking the trend for so many years through his age 38 year of just like having these really solid above average years at a time when you would think that the bat speed should be declining and maybe the pitch recognition isn't quite as sharp and maybe he has to start cheating to get to certain things and the league kind of figures out what he's doing to be successful and is able to counter that effectively. When you would think that like the durability would start to be in question, Justin Turner has like continued to post late into his 30s. It's really a credit to him and how he takes care of himself and the professionalism that he brings. I think that that word professionalism is going to be just ground to dust with Justin Turner this year. You know, not only off the field where, you know, you would expect he's going to be a big clubhouse impact and a real leader for this club immediately and obviously a source of a ton of wisdom and knowledge and experience, but even just from plate appearance to plate appearance, like that, it is the one thing that like stands out to me about him as a hitter. Like he does not give a plate appearance away and he does not give you, like he is never an easy out. Like he is constantly seeing a lot of pitches, fouling stuff off, battling, like just like he's like a boxer leaning on his opponent and just like making you carry his weight, you know. Like no hitter's perfect and no hitter's gonna get on base every time they're at the plate and no hitter's gonna always come up with a big hit, but even when he makes outs, even when he ends up walking back to the dugout, it's after like 4, 5, 6 pitches where he battled and made a guy throw a bunch of stuff and show everybody else on the bench like what he has on that night. Like he really does make a pitcher earn the out against him. And I think that that's something that people are really gonna, you know, appreciate about Justin Turner this year.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there, you know, on the field, off the field. And I guess even to start with, as you alluded to, there is kind of the opportunity cost, because once you have Justin Turner there, you're not going to be adding another DH, which is essentially what he is on this team. He'll bring his gloves to spring training. He'll play some positions for this team in 2024, but he's mainly going to be a DH. And, you know, I think that I would tend to agree with the way you kind of lined these players up. I definitely would have had Hoskins ahead. I thought Hoskins, just because of the youth, you know, that's a really appealing player. But look, I do think Turner's a better fit than Jorge Soler. And I don't think that he's, you know, like it's a different profile, but I think that he's likely to be about as productive as a Jock Peterson. I mean, they're certainly getting paid comparably, so the industry values them similarly when it comes to what they can do this year. So I think on the field, you look at some of the projection systems and, you know, you can see that there is optimism projected for 105, 110 WRC plus. Like that would be great. But, you know, I don't know if you saw this article yet, Arden, but Nick Ashbourne looked at the history of 39-year-olds or older players who got at least 400 plate appearances in the last 15 years. And man, it's a short list. And essentially everyone on the list is a Hall of Famer, or, you know, would be without PED concerns. Like it's Beltre, it's Pujols, it's A-Rod, it's Beltron. It's names like that. These are the guys who get 400 plate appearances at that point in their career. It's tough to do. You have to be a really, really good hitter. And Justin Turner has been that. And I think he could join that group. But all of this to say, it's not a guarantee. Once you get to be 39, 40 years old, it just becomes harder to succeed consistently against the best pitchers in the world.
Yeah, I looked into that stuff a little bit too when I wrote about him after the signing. And last year, there were only four players in their age 39 season or older who made more than 150 plate appearances. Miguel Cabrera led the way with 370 on what was essentially a retirement tour. Joey Votto had the highest OPS of any of them at 747. Yeah. And so the Blue Jays are probably counting on Justin Turner for a bit better than a 747 OPS this year. They'd like it to be closer to the 800 that he had last year. Speaking of Votto, by the way, just to echo your point, this will thankfully put an end to the Votto to the Blue Jays stuff.
Were you over that?
Well, you're not adding a 40-year-old next to the 39-year-old right now.
No, and Votto wants playing time, so.
Yeah, two guys who are primary DHs. Yeah, there's just no room for Votto here. I was never sold on that idea, to be honest with you. As much as I love Votto, like when you and I went to Cincy this year and he gave us a bunch of time, like we had a great conversation with him. He was awesome. Like there was so much insight in those 20 minutes that he shared with us on a very busy day. Super appreciative of that. But yeah, I just never thought it was a good fit for the Blue Jays. But with Turner and the age, like it's, you're almost just hoping that it, like the best case is just gradual decline, right? Because he has been declining for several years now. Like this is a guy who was one of the best hitters on the planet in his Dodgers days.
Into left, and this ball well hit. Back toward that wall and gone. The Dodgers have opened up a can here in the sixth.
And like he's no longer that. He's still solidly above average, but you just hope that the decline is gradual for another year instead of being a steep drop off, which you often do see with players late in their 30s, where they like remember how Brandon Belt looked in April. For a lot of guys, that's just their season when they are really late in their careers and they show up and it's, oh geez, he doesn't have it anymore. Like just age, it hits fast in MLB. And like, look, if you want to look for them, you can find them as far as just like cautionary signs with Turner, like really struggled with four seam fastballs last year, -7 run value against that pitch. That is the pitch you're going to see most often at the big league level is a four seam fastball. So, you know, you're going to want Justin Turner to show like just a bit better production against that pitch. You know, you mentioned the projection systems. You know, I think Steamer is like pretty realistically cautious on him with a 105 weighted runs created plus. I think Zips is at 115. Realistic expectation probably in the middle there with like a 110 WRC plus. I think that, you know, if you're looking to kind of set expectations, that's probably where it should fall.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. And you know, speaking of kind of those off-field benefits, I totally agree with you on Votto. He's got so many great insights on the game, and I actually think like hearing Justin Turner talk as he was being introduced to the Toronto media, I really would put him in that category. He seems super insightful, really thoughtful. He's got tons of experience in the game alongside some of the game's best players, played in the World Series with the Dodgers, played in the playoffs basically every single year with the Dodgers. So this is someone who I think, and I really liked the way he talked about relating to younger players, because you know, it's not as though this guy assumes he is going to command respect. He said he's going to have to earn their respect. He's going to show the younger players respect, and then hope that that leads to productive, you know, interactions and conversations. And I thought that was such a cool way of looking at it, because, you know, it's really, he's not assuming anything. He's not walking in there as the, you know, thinking that he's like automatically going to be the leader of this team, but he has a chance to emerge as one of the leaders on this team because he is intent on showing those guys the respect that they've earned by getting to this point in their major league careers.
Are you expecting like 140 games from him this year?
I think if you get 140 games, you're thrilled, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you get like, honestly, even if you get 450 plate appearances of a 105 WRC plus, that's probably a 1.5-2 win player. Like you're good with that, I think.
So it very likely he falls short of what Brandon Belt was last year, because Brandon Belt, it was only around 400 plate appearances, but it was a 138 WRC plus. It was like a 2.5 win season. it's kind of hard to imagine Justin Turner having that kind of impact on the Blue Jays.
Yeah, Brandon Belt had a sneaky, really good season for the Jays. So, you know, that is a high bar. I think, like, at the same time, Brandon Belt's BABIP last year was 370. There was some luck involved. You know, I just brought that up right now because I knew it was high. 370, like, that's not sustainable. That's not what he was. I mean, he did it, so I guess give him credit, but there was some good luck in there. And I think that from a pure talent standpoint, Justin Turner has the talent to go out there. And I think your point about fastballs is really interesting because I think that early in the season, you're going to see teams challenge him with fastballs up in the zone and see if he can get around on it and see if he can make them pay. So that's going to be a real test for him. But he's done it before. He's passed that test when he was 36 and 37 and 38. So maybe he can do it when he's 39.
Yeah, if I'm seeing this stuff, I promise you the Tampa Bay Rays are seeing that stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, he's going to see a lot of fastballs. He's going to be targeted with righties as well, like hasn't performed as well against righties in recent years. I certainly don't think he's like a platoon bat at all. But, like, I think you do need to manage expectations here when you're talking about Turner, which is, like, another reason why. If when you're looking at the Blue Jays offseason, it'd be great if Justin Turner and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa were like these luxury bench pieces that the Blue Jays were adding as like a, you know, super stacked contender. If these were guys that they were only looking for 350, 400 plate appearances out of and looking to deploy them in optimal matchups. But just the way the Blue Jays are currently constructed, they're going to start the season, unless there's another addition to come, which is always possible, but they're going to start the season really depending on IKF and Turner as near everyday players.
Yeah. Yeah, they really will. So you got to get those guys through healthy. Probably means we see Davis Schneider in the outfield a fair bit as maybe a right-handed complement to someone like Adalton Varsho at times. But before we take a break here, I do want to close the loop on Turner. And you wrote this week at sportsnet.ca an interesting piece making the case that, hey, this guy should actually be considered for the leadoff spot. So tell us your thoughts there and maybe how likely you think that it is that that actually happens.
Unlikely that it actually happens. I think that George Springer is gonna lead off for the Blue Jays, but like I think there is a case to be made that Turner is a better option than him and that Springer would be in a better option batting cleanup. And this is not to say that Justin Turner is the prototypical ideal leadoff hitter. He absolutely is not, but of the options the Blue Jays have, I feel like he is the best one. Because the Blue Jays do not have Ricky Henderson on their team. As far as I know, Ricky Henderson remains retired for like decades now. So just based off of what is available to the Blue Jays, I see Turner as a guy who runs a super high OBP. He gets on base a ton. He does not strike out a lot. He walks enough. It's not like a double-digit walk rate, but it's pretty close. As we were talking about earlier, he like really battles, makes a pitcher work. We were talking about like a top 10 player in pitches per plate appearance. So you know that he is like not going to be a quick out early in a game. He is going to make a pitcher, throw all this stuff, show the rest of the bench like what he is utilizing on that day. And then the contact rates as well with Turner like are exceptional. It's one thing that like really has not dropped off for him late in his career. Last year he ran like close to an 85% contact rate. He just gets his bat to everything, and I think that that's really valuable in a leadoff hitter when it comes to spoiling pitches, fouling stuff off, just putting the ball in play and putting a little bit of pressure on the defense. And like when you're leading off, Justin Turner being a leadoff hitter does not mean he can't be a quote unquote run producer. When you're leading off, you are only guaranteed to hit without runners on base once in a game. After that, the next three times, four times that you come up, there are liable to be runners on base. And when you think about it, like where is the speed in the Blue Jays lineup going to be? It's going to be towards the bottom with Varsho, with Kiermaier. That's pretty much it. Blue Jays aren't going to be a great speed team. That's another reason why, like, I think you just write off the speed element of it because the Blue Jays aren't going to be a team that's going to like burn around the bases. They were a really poor base running team last year and they just lost like
so
to
bad.
They just lost two of their better base runners in Merrifield and Chapman and replaced them with like IKF, who's so-so, and Turner, who's going to be like one of the slowest guys in the league. So the Blue Jays aren't going to be this like, you know, burn around the bases team. So why do you care about having, there's nobody that you're going to put in the leadoff spot who's going to be a burner. If anything, you're going to have Varsho and Kiermaier coming up towards the bottom of your lineup, and if they are getting on base, then now you have Turner coming up from the leadoff spot to ideally drive them in, or to at least like extend late innings when you are either trying to pad a lead or trying to rally. So I think that of the options the Blue Jays have, he's one of their better fits for leadoff.
Yeah, I think it is a fit. I mean, it's an interesting, and you, by the way, you just brought back so many flashbacks when you mentioned the base running of last year's team. It was so bad, and I
don't see why they're going to be any better. It's
a fair point. Chapman honestly was pretty good for the most part, and then everyone's a year older. Yeah, I wouldn't count on this to be a great base running team by any stretch. I mean, they need to get out of their own way. That's the biggest thing, and they can do that. They just need to make better decisions on the bases. That'll be big for them in the spring. That has to happen because you cannot hand opponents that many outs the way they did in 2023. And it's a good thing that they have a new season ahead of them, because that was one of the reasons that last year was not the year they wanted. But as far as Turner, yeah, like, you know, I think that they're going to start the season with Springer as leadoff hitter. It sounds like you know, sort of expect that as well. But hey, if Springer misses a week and a half with a hamstring, like, you could easily put Justin Turner up there. And, you know, end of the day, you're just stacking your better hitters at the top. He is one of their better hitters. I see no reason that he couldn't be a candidate, even if I do think that Springer, by virtue of what he's done in that role over the course of his career, is likely to be the one who starts the season there.
Well, and I think that Springer is just a better bet this year as well to slug, to make really hard contact consistently, to run a high barrel rate, or at least a higher barrel rate than Justin Turner, who ran a career low one in 2023. Like, I just think that like Springer's more of a power threat at this point. So I'd actually rather have him batting cleanup with Bo hitting second and Vlad hitting third. Again, I get that Justin Turner is going to be not only like one of the slowest players on the Blue Jays, but one of the slowest players in baseball. But I mean, the Rays didn't really care that Yandy Diaz is super slow. Like, that didn't stop them from batting him lead off. The Phillies don't care that Kyle Schwarber doesn't, you know, burn around the bases. I mean, they hit him lead off. You know, guys like JP Crawford and Altuve, Brandon Nimmo, like, these aren't super fast players, but they're all effective leadoff hitters because they like work really discerning and grinding plate appearances, and they make a lot of contact, and they run really above average on base percentages. Like, I just think that, you know, we have expanded our idea of what a leadoff hitter can be. And if Ricky Henderson isn't on your roster, you kind of have to deal with the personnel that you have. And of the personnel that the Blue Jays have, you know, I kind of look at it objectively and just look at the profiles, type of hitters that they are. And I think that Justin Turner is a bit of a better option, a bit of a better fit for this Blue Jays lineup than George Springer.
Yeah, it's a reasonable case, for sure. So, you know, it's really just get on base and go from there, and Turner can do that. We will step aside here for a moment on At the Letters, but we still have Vlad Guerrero Jr.'s arbitration to discuss, and we will also look ahead a little bit when we continue. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
So two on with two down for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And a fastball hit to deep left field. He got it! A three-run homer for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And isn't that a good sign? And a three-run sign.
Welcome back to At the Letters. And look, we have to get to the big news of the week, which is the Vlad Guerrero Jr. arbitration hearing.
Maybe in your world. Big news in Ben's world.
He's
been waiting all offseason for this.
You know what? It's the big news in the world of the Blue Jays, and this is now in the books. We know that he beat the Blue Jays in arbitration. He will get $19.9 million instead of the $18.05 million that the Blue Jays had offered him. And it's just, I don't really know where to begin with this, but you know, first of all, we said last week, like I thought that Vladdy was going to win this case. I thought that the Blue Jays filed a super, super, super aggressive number and that their chances of winning were pretty slim. Not surprised at all that Vladdy won this case. It's just not a great vibe. It's not a great look. I don't think it's catastrophic, but it's not a great look for anyone here.
You said it's, you know, big news in the Blue Jays world. I feel like it's bigger news in the MLB world globally, just because this is a pretty historic decision. Like, this is the highest salary ever awarded via arbitration. This is like setting a precedent for all arbitrations that could and would involve similar players going forward. You know, I think that, and you would know this, there would have been heavy involvement on the player's side via the player association, and then on the team's side by the league. So, like, I don't think this is like the biggest news in the Blue Jays world, but I do think that, like, more globally across MLB, it is, you know, something that is going to be noted.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, on a quiet week in February, I would say it probably is the biggest news in the Blue Jays world. But yeah, you're totally right to say that it's also big within the MLB landscape, in the sense that, you know, you do have implications for the broader industry here. And I think that partly what's happening here is the Blue Jays, along with MLB and the labor relations department, you take a swing here. And if the Blue Jays had won this case, this would have had implications for the next position player who goes in there with numbers comparable to Vlad, because at that point, if the raise is $3.55 million and that's established as precedent for the kind of season that he had, where he was pushing up against 30 and 100, and if that becomes a $3.55 million raise, that is really good for teams that want to limit their costs and really bad for players. But ultimately, you know, and this is why I said last week that I thought Vladdy was going to win, is that was a number that was super aggressive. And it just, the precedent was more on the side of the player in the view of the arbitrators, clearly. And when you look at Pete Alonso and Juan Soto, the raises they got, 6 for Alonso, 5.9 for Juan Soto, these are raises that everyone agrees those guys had better seasons than Vladdy. No one's saying that Vladdy was at that level, but he was closer to that level than he was to 3.55. So he ends up getting nearly $20 million in ARB.
Yeah, and, you know, playing time is a huge consideration in this as well. And Vlad is a guy who has posted consistently over the course of his career. And, you know, you mentioned the raises, and that's, you know, that's fair. But, like, when it comes to an arbitration hearing, like, for both sides, are you not just trying to manipulate the midpoint, which, yeah, right, in this case would have been, like, just a hair under $19 million. It would have been, like, 18.97 or something like that, just considering, just trying to do some quick math here. Like, essentially, if you're on Guerrero's side, like, you're not trying to convince the arbitrators that you're worth $19.9 million. You're trying to convince them that you are worth a penny above the midpoint, that you're, yep, worth $19 million. And if you're the Blue Jays, you're not trying to convince the arbitrators that Vlad's worth 18.05. You're trying to convince them that he's worth, like, 18.8. So I don't, you know, that's just, I think, some necessary context when we look at, you know, the raises that Soto and Alonso got versus Vlad. And I think the other like interesting context to this as well is that, like, Vlad's situation, like, it's so unique. Like, it's such an interesting confluence of factors where he had this early season debut in his rookie year that allowed him to be a Super 2 player. So he's taking 4 trips through. Alonso's only taken 3 trips through. And then he had this monster MVP season, or MVP caliber season, MVP finalist season in 2021, right before he entered the process. So, like, he could not have timed the best season of his career to this point any better than having that in 2021, because, like, as I'm sure you have heard many, many times in arbitration, if you start low, you're going to end low. And if you start high, you have a much better chance of ending high. So, you know, the confluence of factors around Vlad being Super 2 and just around what his platform season entering the first year of the process was, I think that plays into this as well and makes him a bit more unique and a bit harder to just, like, map his numbers onto Alonso's.
And even as you move ahead here, because he has one more remaining arbitration year, then for 2025, by winning this case, that means that he will be platforming off of 19.9. So whatever he ends up with next year, let's say it's a $5 million raise for argument's sake, then boom, that's 25. Instead of if he had earned a $5 million raise on closer to 18, then it's 23. So these gains will continue to build for Vlad Guerrero Jr. At this point, like, I don't know. We haven't heard from Vlad Guerrero Jr. It'll be interesting to hear what he has to say, likely next week when he addresses the media at spring training. So we'll learn more about his perspective then, and that's super important in this. But, you know, outside looking in, my guess is the same process occurs next year, and then he hits free agency. I don't think that this was the kind of arbitration back and forth that necessarily lays a ton of groundwork for a deal. And so I'm certainly not holding my breath for a Vlad Guerrero Jr. extension announcement.
Yeah, and we kind of got into the like discomfort or the unease of the process, some of the tension or like consternation that can arise from this in certain cases. Like we talked about that last week. So, you know, you probably don't need to go through it all again, but like I will say, like, one thing that I do notice is that media and fans really tend to kind of like over dramatize these hearings a little bit. Like they portray it like it's a movie, like it's Glengarry Glen Ross or something, and the Blue Jays are gonna like walk into that room and be yelling and screaming and, you know, like just emotionally like tearing Vlad apart as a competitor and an athlete and a human being. I think it's much more likely that it was just a very business-like proceeding, and the Blue Jays in a very like calculated and calm manner just presented some alternative comparables to Soto and Alonso that ended up with lower salaries when they went through arbitration, and just made like a very calm argument about why Vlad's case is more like those players than it is alike Soto and Alonso.
Yeah, and I don't see any ill will here on the part of the Blue Jays, and I don't think that their intention with this was, you know, personal or loaded or charged. And I do think that you're right to observe that, well, some fans and media, you know, maybe add meaning onto some of this stuff when there's not meaning intended from the Blue Jays. But again, that still leaves open the possibility of how does Vlad Jr. interpret this? And even if the Blue Jays don't go into this with any ill will, which I don't think they do, Mark Shapiro has been working in and around arbitration for decades and decades. Ross Atkins has been around this world for decades. So this isn't their first arbitration case, or their second or their third. But for Vladdy, it's his first time, you know, in a hearing room. For him, this means more. This is one of only a handful of times that he's ever going to go through arbitration. So there's more personal meaning attached to it from his end than there is from the Blue Jays. And again, we don't know exactly how he is going to feel about this or what it was like to be in that room as the Blue Jays were making these arguments. But I don't want to assume one way or the other. And I'm going to be really interested to see how he frames this once we do hear from him, because, you know, even if it wasn't intended as a personal affront, you know, this stuff can be taken in ways that wasn't intended on the part of the team.
Yeah, you got to allow him the opportunity to say his piece about it and let us know his thoughts and where he stands on it. But I do think, like, regardless of how he feels about it, his motivations and his incentives to perform as well as possible for the Toronto Blue Jays in 2024 and 2025 remain unchanged. Regardless of how he feels about what happened in that room, like, he's still playing for that raise on 19.9 that you identified, like, with a good season in 2024, like, he can go up to $25-26 million for 2025. Like, he has the same incentives to go out and perform well for himself and for the Blue Jays. And as we talked about last time, it's not like an extension was realistic between these two sides at this time. Certainly not like the not really a 2-year extension either, right? Like, not a 10-year one and not a 2-year one. Like, I just don't think that there was really reason on either side to like go down that road. Like, I think both sides were disincentivized from having an extension of any length at this time, so that doesn't change. Like, I just don't, even if Vlad is a little bit pissed about how this went down, I just don't know what it materially changes going forward.
Right. He's going to be super motivated. I think he's going to have a really good year. I think he's going to be a hugely important part of this team. I mean, these are the most like obvious statements you could make, right? Like, Vladdy is so important to this team, obviously. And I do think that he'll get over it, but we'll see what he has to say. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, you see at the same time someone like Bobby Witt Jr. signing a huge, huge extension with the Kansas City Royals, and he's a 2+ service time player, as opposed to, you know, Vladdy, who's now well into his arbitration years. And so I sort of think the more time goes by here, when you look at both Vladdy and Bo, the window, if you were ever going to extend these guys, was probably a couple years ago. And I just don't see that really happening at this moment in time.
Yeah, but and that's the sort of stuff that the Blue Jays, as a team that is willing to like run payrolls in excess of the luxury tax, they don't necessarily have to do that stuff because they can compete for these players in the free agent market. Teams like the Royals have to do stuff like that, or at least feel like they have to do stuff. They obviously could spend as much money as as they want at any given time, but they don't. We know that. We know many teams don't spend as much money as like the sport permits you to spend, even just below the kind of soft cap of the luxury tax. So like, I do feel like smaller market, lower payroll teams like the Royals and others feel like they have to sign those long-term extensions early in players' careers, where the Blue Jays can feel a bit more confident that, yeah, we can run things out year to year. Like, we can stomach really high salaries of $19.9 million in arbitration. Like, we can fit that in our payroll, in our budget. And then when the player goes to market and goes out and sees what their actual market is with all 30 teams, if they go out and get like a really good offer somewhere, we can match it or exceed it, or we can let that player go for draft pick compensation. But like, you know, I don't think that the Blue Jays have as much worry about letting players go year to year through ARB and then reach the open market and actually realize their worth as a lot of other teams do.
Right. And if you're the biggest and best teams out there, if you're the Yankees, you can re-sign Aaron Judge. If you're the Dodgers, you can re-sign Clayton Kershaw. But, you know, it's also interesting with the Dodgers. A lot of the time, they let guys go. And so whether that's, you know, a Bellinger or a Seager, or so many cases over the years, they've let really, really good players go. Trey Turner, Manny Machado. And that's part of how they do their business, too. So we'll see how that unfolds with the Jays here. Before we move on, Arden, anything else you want to add on Vladdy and arbitration?
No, but you mentioned the Witt deal, which like I think is such a great deal for him this early in his career, like guaranteeing himself $270 million or whatever it was, $280 million, however much the actual overall guarantee is with all those opt-outs. Like, the amount of control that the Royals gave Bobby Witt Jr. over the direction of their franchise at multiple instances in that deal is remarkable. I love that deal for Bobby Witt at this point in his career. And honestly, don't love it for the Royals, but do love seeing them spend the money, and do love seeing them like give out a contract just of that scale. Obviously something that they haven't done before. Like, very happy to see that, but very much understand why like the Blue Jays would not have signed Bo Bichette to that deal 2 years into his career.
Yes. And Bobby Witt Jr. too is a different player. Just when you look at from a pure skill standpoint, someone who is 99th percentile speed, like, I don't know, that's a special skill that he has. I think it's a home run for Bobby Witt Jr. I like it for Kansas City still. Like, if you're the Royals, I don't think you want to undo that deal. Like, I think he's such a good player that you probably want to do what you can to keep him around.
I just don't love the opt-outs, just purely from their perspective. I'm happy this deal happened because it's fascinating, and I'm always happy to see players get paid, and always happy to see players have a ton of control over their careers. Like, that's just what kind of boggles my mind about, is the amount of control that the Royals like gave to him. Like, he did not kick back as much to them in this deal as I would have expected he would need to in order to get those opt-outs with like, was it $35 million salaries? Like, he basically for 4 years running will have the choice of going to market and signing an even bigger deal
or just having a $35 million salary in the next year. And so what, and he ended up giving them like, I think it was just 3 years of his potential free agency in exchange for like $100 million. So I just think this deal is like such a win for Bobby Witt.
Yeah, they must love him as a dude because, yeah, they're making a big bet. You're not going to make a lot of signings like this if you're the Kansas City Royals. But
there are four off seasons consecutively where he can just like completely hard left turn like the trajectory of their franchise.
Yeah, it's a great deal for him. It really is.
it's a ton of control they gave him.
Now, that's probably the most time we've ever spent talking about the Kansas City Royals on ATL in a long time. But it's a really interesting deal. Maybe from there, we'll go back to the American League East, where there was another deal that does warrant some attention from us. And after a very, very quiet offseason, for the most part, the Orioles went out there and they acquired Corbin Burnes. And for the Blue Jays, for anyone in the American League East, this is a pretty big deal. Corbin Burnes is an ace. He's one of the top 15 pitchers in baseball. Now he's going to be in Baltimore. As you're looking at the American League East right now, Arden, I mean, how does this Burnes trade shape your understanding of Baltimore?
Great deal for the Orioles. Now they need to extend him and also sign Blake Snell to a like 5 or 6 year deal. And then I will finally give the Orioles their full due. But this is at least a step in the right direction. Like, I've been getting on the Orioles forever about how they won't do anything to surround this incredible young core with talent. So I have to give them some flowers for actually going out and doing the damn thing and really like not paying a crazy price either to acquire Corbin Burnes. So good for them. Burnes is like top 10 pitcher in baseball. Probably, you know, you might say top 15, you might even say top 5, like kind of depends on how you feel about the season he just had. But dude is durable. Dude is a competitor. He's nasty. I can't wait for the first Burnes v. Gossman matchup that we're going to see this year, because like that game's going to be like 2 hours long and it's going to be just incredible theater to watch. And it's going to be tight and intense. And the plate appearances are going to be absolute grinds for the hitters. And it's just going to be wicked to watch that. And as far as the AL East more globally, like, it's going to be a bloodbath. And it's been the most competitive division in baseball essentially like my entire life. I'm 36 years old and I don't remember a time when it wasn't like, man, the AL East is stacked. You look at the projections and what, four of the five teams are like within the top 10 across MLB, and I think you know which teams those obviously are. And I think you can even just like squint and see the Red Sox being competitive and having some things go right for them, and being at least like a 500 team, maybe a little bit below. But like, they got some decent youth coming out of their system. You know, debuted Rafaela last year. They got more guys coming. They play in like a crazy ballpark where crazy things happen and they get crazy results. So yeah, it's going to be just a super competitive division. It is a disadvantage for the Blue Jays, like relative to the Twins or the Cardinals, who don't have to build like teams as good as the Blue Jays would have to in order to win their division. Like, you could win one of those central divisions with like 86, 87 wins. That ain't going to happen for the Blue Jays or for the Rays or the Yankees or the Orioles. But I don't know, like, getting mad at like the competitiveness of the division is kind of like just yelling at the sky about the weather. Like, it's just not energy well spent. It is what it is. It's the best league in the world. It's the best division within the best league in the world. It's going to be really competitive and really compelling theater, and you just sign up for the ride, strap in, and enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's Major League Baseball. You're going to be facing good teams. If you want to win the World Series, you're going to have to beat really good teams. And it, like you say, it's totally unproductive to really dwell on, oh, what if it was a little easier? Like, you're in this to compete against the best and beat the best. And that's the challenge facing all these teams. I think the Burnes trade, I agree. I think it's a great deal for Baltimore. Absolutely love it for them. I think it's a pretty good deal for Milwaukee too. I mean, hate to say it, you'd love to see them maybe spend and retain talent a little bit more, but Joey Ortiz is a major league infielder. That's going to help them. DL Hall can be at least a major league reliever for 1 year of a pitcher who you know, wasn't going to re-sign with Milwaukee. So I like that deal for the Brewers. And, you know, we'll see what they do with Willy Adames if there's a further trade to be made there. But clearly the Brewers have visions of competing a little bit as well. But, you know, the Orioles needed an ace and they get one. And I think that that's good for Baltimore. And I think it's scary for everyone else in that division.
Yeah. And so when you even just look at the AL East and you look at the Fangraphs projections on how they think this division's going to shake out, I bet you some Blue Jays fans are kind of surprised with how the Blue Jays land and like the various projections that are coming out this week. This is projections week when it's, you know, Pacoda and, you know, Zips and Steamer and the Fangraphs depth charts, which does a really good job. But you look at those Fangraphs depth charts and like no team in the AL East is given even a 40% chance of winning the division. So like, I think it's kind of like a mistake to just, you know, kind of look at the win total and just look at where the Blue Jays are in the projected like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 standing. Like, realize that there are four teams in this division. The Fangraphs Fields has a double digit chance of winning the division. Like, it is super competitive. There is a lot of overlap in these projections. Like when you were looking at the win distributions, like not just the Blue Jays are going to win 89.3 games, but the distributions between like the 25th percentile outcome and the 75th, there's a ton of overlap between the top four teams in this division, and it just would not take much in the way of injuries or unexpected over or under performance that could swing the fates of one, two, all of these teams, jumble things up and make things like fall out in a different way than we're expecting. Like, it looks like four really good teams in this division, they're going to be jockeying for position well into late August and early September.
Yeah, it's going to be so competitive in that mix. I think that the Yankees are a good team, and I'm almost surprised at how much the projections like the Yankees. It's like, they really do seem to put New York at the top. And I like the Stroman ad for them. Obviously, Juan Soto is a monster. I mean, that's a great pickup for the Yankees. But I personally, we talked about this before, I still see Baltimore as the top team. I think Baltimore is going to be really, really good. And I think the Jays and Yankees and Rays are in a really close tier, not that far behind. And all three of those teams, I think, could make real pushes for the division. If not, they'll obviously be in the mix for wild cards. But yeah, this is going to be a super competitive division once again.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying last week. Like, people get way too high on teams following seasons in which they overperform expectations, i.e. the Orioles, and they get way too low on teams following seasons in which they underperform expectations, i.e. the Yankees, who missed the playoffs altogether while the Orioles won over 100 games. Like, the thing about projection systems, and you can take it or leave it with projections, like, I get it, right? But the thing about them is they do not care what happened last year. Like, they don't care the Orioles won 100 games or that the Yankees missed the playoffs. Like, all they do is project each individual player going forward, make some playing time estimations, add up the totals on each team, spit out a number, and then adjust as new information presents itself each day throughout the regular season. So, like, you know, I know people get frustrated with them and want to point out their flaws and, you know, where they are wrong. And yes, projections are often wrong. As George Box said, all models are wrong, but some are useful, Ben. And I do think that the projection systems are useful for just removing the bias of what happened last year and how we feel generally about teams, just of being objective, modeled on historical data, just being free of that emotional bias that we are all carrying around with us at all times, whether we like to or not. I think that over time we have seen that models and projection systems are more likely to be accurate than your gut intuition, because none of us could possibly process the wealth of data and information that a model can. So they're not the be-all and end-all. They're going to be wildly off about some players, but they're going to be pretty close on many more. And I think that's why we look to them to kind of guide our thoughts entering a season at this point on February 8th, when we know literally nothing about what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's useful, right? And look, like, do you want a projection system just to confirm what you already think every single time? Because to
some
me, that
people
sounds,
do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That sounds pretty boring, right? If I go, if in my mind, I think the Orioles are the best, and everywhere I look, it says, yes, Ben, you're right. The Orioles are the best. Then, like, what's the point of that? I've learned nothing. I haven't expanded or broadened my perspective at all. So these things are really useful just from the standpoint of making you reconsider some of your assumptions. And I think, too, hey, they could change if and when more information becomes available. And we're at a point in the offseason where there still are a lot of big free agents out there and even some smaller free agents. So it's worth repeating, as you know, I know we said we're sort of done with the offseason stuff, but like the Blue Jays can still upgrade and there is room on this team for another right-hand hitting outfielder. You and I have talked about it. We've both written about it. But it's worth mentioning once again because you look at this roster and yeah, you probably don't want Dalton Varsho and Kevin Kiermaier, two guys with career OPSs below 700 against left-handed pitching, to be facing lefties all the time. You want to have some reasonable alternative, and there are major league players out there who can help. And so that makes sense as an avenue for the Jays to explore.
Yeah. And this isn't to say that the Blue Jays can't still add towards like the top end of their roster. You know, by all means, like go sign Cody Bellinger, go sign Matt Chapman. I think the Blue Jays right now look at the markets for those two players and do not want to pay the price that is being asked for them, considering a lot of the red flags in their profiles and considering how they would kind of time with the way the rest of the Blue Jays roster and payroll is timed over the next 2 years and beyond. And like, yes, there is the possibility that if their markets crater and that if prices come down, the Blue Jays could get involved. But guess what's going to happen if those prices come down? Jed Hoyer is going to be more involved and Farhan Zaidi is going to be more involved. Like, it's not just the Blue Jays who are out here looking for a deal. So I don't really buy the argument that, oh, the prices come down and the Blue Jays are going to sign one of these guys. Yeah, the prices come down and a lot more teams are going to be interested in signing those guys.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look really realistic to me right now that either of them are signed with the Blue Jays. It's possible. And like I said, the Blue Jays absolutely should look to add more impact, but just looking more realistically towards what they could do on the bench with the money that is available to them. By the way, they're like, I don't know, $5.5 million from that second luxury tax threshold. Do they want to go beyond that? Could they go beyond that? We don't know, but it is something to keep in mind. Yeah, I do look to like a right-handed hitter on the bench, preferably an outfielder, preferably somebody who's a capable outfielder, so you're not like running Davis Schneider and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa out into outfield corners late in games too often. And when you look around like the free agent market, like Tommy Pham sticks out and Michael A. Taylor and Adam Duvall, but those guys are going to cost, you know, $8, $9, $10 million
and they'll want playing time.
They're going to be looking for opportunity more than the Blue Jays can give them, right? The Blue Jays can't really give them the expanded role that they're going to want. So then you go down a tier, right? And you look at, well, yeah, Robbie Grossman looks like a great fit. Switch hitter who, you know, is OPS over 800 against lefties for his career, like annually runs chase and walk rates among the most disciplined hitters in the league. You know, he would definitely be a fit, but like he was a fit last season as well, and the Blue Jays didn't go down that road. So we'll see if that's somebody. I think that like on a minor league deal, you could look to like a Kike Hernandez or an AJ Pollock and like bring them into camp and see if they still have something, see if they can make the team. I think there's some trade possibilities out there. Like I was just mentioning the Giants, like their position to start a rookie, Marco Luciano at shortstop. And he's a really good prospect, you know, consensus top 30, top 40 guy, but he's still a rookie at the game's highest level. So the Blue Jays might want to have, or excuse me, the Giants might want to have something a bit more proven just to spell him. And just in case there are some growing pains at the big league level, you know, Brandon Crawford's now gone. Tyro Estrada's playing second base. So maybe Santiago Espinal is useful to the Giants as a bit of a backup shortstop and a bench infielder. And then maybe the Blue Jays say, hey, Austin Slater is you know, a right-handed outfield bench bat who's in like his final year prior to free agency. And I think he's making around $4 million. Espinal is making like $2.5 million. You know, maybe there's a framework there for the Blue Jays to add their right-handed outfield bench bat in Slater. Maybe it's JD Davis who could come in to play some third base and not have to have Isaiah Kiner-Falefa starting every single day. Maybe he's a guy who comes in and plays against lefties. You know, again, another pending free agent. And the Giants, just because they have a strong system, could pretty easily backfill for both of those situations. So I looked at that as a potential fit. And then I also looked at the Washington Nationals, who have this like crazy right-handed outfielder surplus in Lane Thomas and Victor Robles and Stone Garrett, Alex Call, Jacob Young. They got really good prospects on the way in James Wood and Dylan Cruz. They have a surplus in right-handed hitting outfielders. So I think Lane Thomas is the guy you would want, but he would also drive the highest bargain. Stone Garrett, bit of a wild card. His, you know, year ended with a pretty catastrophic injury. What's he going to be coming back? Maybe Alex Call is the guy who had like a really underwhelming offensive year last year, but hit pretty well against lefties, manages the strike zone, runs a bit, and is a good defender. We know the Blue Jays value those things. So the acquisition cost there ought to be low. And he also has options remaining. So the Blue Jays could just like send him to AAA if things aren't working out. So those are a couple of trade possibilities I would look at as well.
Interesting. You know, it's funny. In these jobs, we hear a lot of like unrealistic trade possibilities. And, you know, and that's fun. That's part of the job. But I think, you know, the Espinal for Slater framework is like the opposite of that. It's like, it's not the sort of thing that's going to get fans like buzzing and all like in every like message board. It's not like the, you know, lead, like have all kinds of people calling into to Fan 590 to discuss it, but it's actually kind of a framework that sort of makes sense for both sides. So you never know. I mean, I think that could sort of make some sense. If I'm the Jays, I'd even try to like go a little bigger, and I would try to get something done for Willy Adames and, you know, try to just push in that extra prospect to get it done, just to augment your position player core, because you know you're going to have opportunity in the course of a long season. So, but I do think, you know, barring that, something along the lines of, hey, a deal for someone like an Austin Slater, like that actually would help. And that might be the sort of thing that on March 15th, it's not a headline maker, but it's a move that sneakily could upgrade. And look, barring that, maybe it's a minor league deal. Maybe it's a waiver claim. Someone less, even less known than an Austin Slater, less established than, you know, than an Alex Call. We're really getting down the list, but that's possible as well.
Yeah, it's hard to be less established than Alex Call, but like this is usually where I trend, is towards the more realistic, unsexy, just like need for need. It makes sense and upgrades a team slightly, moves. Like, look, I think Robert F. Snyder would be a great fit. I don't know why the Red Sox would ever trade him at this point, but Robert F. Snyder is exactly what the Blue Jays need, just in terms of like a vet, good clubhouse guy, would be accepting of the role. He hits lefties really well. He's okay in the outfield. Everybody would like having him around. He would be a great quote for us. Like he would fit so well. You know, I'm looking at like Mark Canha, who is the guy the Blue Jays should have gotten last deadline. Like he was the fit for them at last deadline. And I bet you they're calling the Tigers about Mark Canha at this coming deadline, because what? Like
Tigers are gonna be buying, man, come on.
No,
yeah,
I'm gonna disagree with you on that one, Ben. I say that because like the deadline thing, because I don't think this is something the Blue Jays will find a solution for prior to the regular season. We'll see. I feel like they'll probably just kind of wait it out until the end of spring and see if somebody like shakes loose on waivers, like see if this year's Jordan Luplow you know, becomes available. Like I kind of think that's where this is heading, but maybe it's not, who knows.
The Yankees crater and the Tigers get Juan Soto from New York at the deadline. All right, that's probably my cue to wrap up the podcast, if we're into that territory. Anything else as far as the Blue Jays here? Any thoughts on how they stand within the American League East? Any other last minute trade proposals you want to toss out there?
I'll go on record right now and say like I'm not going to, because everybody for the next 2 months is going to be, and by the way, the next 2 months, like we are so far away from like a game that counts, Ben. Like we're 8 weeks away from a game that counts. We were just talking about the trade deadline. That's like 6 months away. The end of the regular season is 8 months away. Like we'll be completely different people by that point. The Blue Jays, like as a roster, will have turned over by like about 50%. Like from, you think about, there's 26 man roster on opening day, and they're 26 man roster on the last day of the regular season.
Yeah.
Like close to 50% turnover is not unusual.
Is it really that? I would have guessed like a third.
I would put it somewhere between 33 to 50.
Yeah, it'll be a lot.
It's going to be a lot. You're going to have injuries. Guys are going to get DFA'd. Guys are going to get released. Guys are going to make mistakes on social media. Like, a lot of crazy things happen in the course of a baseball season. There's going to be trades. There's going to be players added. There's going to be minor league success stories. Like, maybe Damiano Palmigiani is the everyday third baseman by August. Maybe Alan Rodon, just literally by sheer force of nature, it forces his way onto this team like Davis Schneider did last year. Like, maybe Ricky Tiedemann is like starting really big games down the stretch. Like, the roster is going to look completely different. So like, it's just folly to make any kind of prediction right now. Like, none of us know anything. None of us know what will actually happen when they play the games. And I get that this isn't what people want. Like, people want really like strong and emotional and forceful opinions. But there is a lot of that out there, actually, if you want that. So you can go find it. What you can't find is the person who, at this time a year ago, said the Texas Rangers were going to play the Arizona Diamondbacks in the World Series. You can't find that. You could find a lot of people who said, like, the Padres and Mets just both won the offseason and amassed all of this talent and built juggernauts. And, oh, my goodness, like, what a battle it's going to be between these two teams. Neither of them qualified for October. So I think it's helpful to keep that in mind. And I think the other thing that's helpful to keep in mind as well is that if the Blue Jays won 10 more games last year and finished with 99 wins, you know what they would have ended up doing? Going to the Trop to play a two-game wildcard series. The Blue Jays could have won 10 more games and ended up in the same situation, going off to play a two-game wildcard series on the road. So I'm not saying the Blue Jays shouldn't play to win the division. I'm not saying that like that shouldn't be the goal. But just because like the Blue Jays aren't set up right now, don't appear right now to be contenders for the AL East, doesn't mean they can't have a successful 2024.
Yeah, and I mean, to your point earlier, they kind of are contenders for the American League East. It's just they, with a better offseason, they could have been even stronger contenders for it.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, look, hey, so you said you have some caution when it comes to making predictions, but that's not going to stop me from asking you to make one last one before we step away here. The Super Bowl is coming up this weekend. I've got a prediction. It's going to be Kansas City 23, San Francisco 16. And this is your chance, Arden. If you want to throw a Super Bowl prediction out there, this is your moment.
I guess that I will be rooting for the 49ers just to see something different happen. Cause I really like Brock Purdy as, like the last pick in the draft. And, this guy who is, just overcome throughout his, career in the NFL and who is a really solid game manager. So give me the 49ers.
I think Mahomes is built for these moments. His presence of mind and composure is
different.
He is just different. He is incredible. I know you're saying that somewhat ironically, but like he is his focus and his confidence is off the charts. It is his self-belief is exactly what you need as a professional athlete. It is like, it's unbelievable how much he believes in himself, and he's so talented. He backs it up. Mahomes is really tough to stop in these moments. So I'm going with Kansas City.
Is this like his fifth or his sixth Super Bowl? Something like that?
Feels like it's every year.
Right? That in and of itself, for a guy who like can't be a day over 30 at this point, like that's
he's like 27. Like he's young.
that's pretty impressive. Like you are watching one of the greats, whether you like him or not. You're watching one of the all-time greats right now.
Just love sports. Last prediction for me, Taylor Swift will be there. She'll make it.
Cool.
Sweet.
Oh, awesome. Man. There it is. You heard it here first on At the Letters. That's all our Super Bowl content for this week. We'll come back and discuss more when there are further baseball updates. In the meantime, thank you all so much for listening and sticking with us here on ATL. On behalf of Arden Zwelling, Christian Ryan, and Nick Andrade, we will talk to you soon.